Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We're glad to have you here. Please smash the like button, follow and subscribe anywhere you're watching. Words. Whiskey.
One sip.
That's the cold open. It's him doing the words whiskey. Yeah, that's the cold open.
Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are glad to have you here. Please like, follow, and subscribe wherever you're watching or listening. And if you would like to become a member and get access to our exclusive content like the Skiff Members Only Show, go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how.
And also come join the Discord where you can talk about the news with us and you can also post some dank memes. And they might be featured on the show like this one right here. This was actually my meme, so pull it out there. It's my favorite meme archetype of the week is we have everything that happened around with the UFC fight with like Elon Musk, RFK, Trump going on. And here they are on Air Force Trump eating a bunch of McDonald's and RFK looking like he was peer pressured into doing drugs to sit at the cool kids table.
Can you zoom in on his face? Yeah, his expression is just priceless.
Yeah.
He's just so uncomfortable.
If we just kind of
like, it's a camera.
Oh God. He's like, this is going to ruin my reputation.
Yeah. I, Donald Trump Jr. He tweeted out, America becomes healthy tomorrow.
And Mike Johnson is just happy to be here.
Yeah. Yeah. Why is he there?
Mike Skiff Johnson hanging out in the background.
I did see a lot of people speculating on this is like Trump just gets to bring Mike Johnson along to make it him seem cool. And now he's just going to go along with everything because he's that type of guy.
He doesn't want to be on the outs of the cool kids club. Yeah. I think it's a good strategy.
I think that's probably true because that has been everything that you saw at the UFC fight was just Mike Johnson just being awkwardly in the background. It's perfect.
David, what are we talking about today?
So Democrats pull Michael Jackson and start looking at the they-them in the mirror.
Oh, shit.
That was one of your better ones.
Thank
you.
That was good.
Thank you. We're going to be reviewing why the Democrats lost the election this year. Less so, we've kind of covered it from why Trump won. And I think this is a major part of the discourse since the election is interpreting what the Democrats can do better, how their coalition needs to change, messaging, strategy, all that kind of stuff.
I thought it was because Latinos are racist.
No, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that because it's definitely the Latinx thing.
And also black men are misogynist.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
More importantly than anything, I want to know what The View thinks. Because
we're going to get to The View, but we're going to start out with Bill Maher. Ooh. Did what was probably one of the kickoffs for this beyond Bernie Sanders' reaction.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's kind of kicked off by Bill Maher coming after the Democrats the way he did. We got a little live reaction for that.
It's the losers. Losers look in the mirror. No? Well, maybe you should. Sorry. Well, that's my feeling. Losers look in the mirror. Okay. You know, for months, Democrats have been saying, how is this even close? And they're right. It wasn't.
Yikes.
Yeah, and he went on in his on his show, he went on a massive tirade after that. Like, he dedicated a whole show to this idea of just Democrats needing to take a little bit of a critical view at themselves and see where they went wrong. And it was met with a lot of vitriol from the left, of course.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably one of the hardest things ever, right? To suffer a fairly decisive defeat.
Yeah.
In any sense, let alone electorally, something you care a lot about, and then go introspective, right, and think, okay, how can I look at myself and how I might have been misled or how I might have made a mistake. I mean, that's got to be one of the hardest things to do, just as a person in general.
Well, just look at them losing the entire culture. Look at everything that's going on. Like the UFC was an example of it, but also just everywhere in sports right now, everybody's doing end zone touchdown dances with the Trump dance, and you see all the praise that's coming with Trump at the UFC fight with the John Jones fight and giving him the belts and all of that. Right?
Like, yeah, I saw him referred to as Republican Caesar. Which I think is pretty funny.
Well, it's just because the left has had such a dominant, has had the entire culture under its control for decades now, and now it's just all gone. And they're trying to figure out what to do, and instead of kind of building their own culture, they're just like shaming everybody still, and they're not recognizing what happened here. It's like, no, you're not the cool kids anymore.
Yeah.
Like we're kind of done with the whole shame tactics that you've been putting us on right now.
Well, fortunately, I mean, there have been like different responses from various different contingents of the left, some more introspective and a little more critical than others who are still kind of maybe just keeping the blinders on and saying, no, this isn't happening. This isn't happening.
And that's where The View is at. The View is definitely, and we got a video of a View correspondent basically making that case that there is no reason for Democrats really to do it. Actually, it's just Donald Trump. There's not really a case. It's just more of a how dare you question how great Kamala was.
Yeah.
Is kind of their approach. So, and then, of course, you got the American people are sexist story, the misogyny, weren't ready for a woman narrative. And then next to that, a black woman, if Kamala's black, indeed. Black.
I see the film.
She's now a black woman.
And I think you got a lot of the low influencer level analysis, which is all about like looking at, and this is really dumb, looking at who had a majority of a demographic vote for Kamala or who voted less than their historical norm for the Democrat and blaming that demographic. And that's what it looks like when you say white women are the problem. Black women are the only people who are good anymore. Black men are disappointment, you know, all that kind
Latinos.
Of. And Latinos. Latinx.
Sorry.
Latinx. You can't. Oh, wait. We own the culture now. We can say Latino.
We can say. I don't think anyone stopped. I think there was like 12 people that said Latinx. And some of the, and then they got shamed for it because it was dumb.
By Latinos. They were like, What the fuck is that?
There's a great skit comedy of from Free the People, and they have these detectives, and they're trying to find Latinx. It's like the X-Files. It's so good. It is so funny. And they're talking to all these Mexicans, like, have you seen a Latinx? He's like, no, man. It's like, what are you talking about? It's hilarious.
Let's get into this this View clip here. Are we going to watch it?
I don't know where the View clip is.
Oh.
Where's
very
the
top.
Right at the very top.
This is The View.
I didn't capitalize the V.
Yeah, sorry. It threw me off. I just didn't see. I was looking through every other link besides that one.
I'm glad we have the professional in charge over here.
Yeah.
This is good.
Sorry, I was like searching for it, like mad. Okay, here we go.
About Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, child.
Child.
She must have been absent the day in kindergarten where they did the lesson. If you've got nothing good to say, don't say anything at all. I mean, why, Nancy? Why? I find this so unproductive, nasty, so unnecessary. It's like she wants to make sure that people know it wasn't her. She has no blame in this. I said Biden should have gotten out earlier. I said there shouldn't have been a primary. Don't blame me. I think it's really unseemly.
Yeah.
And, you know, frankly, it's done with,
yeah.
Right? These criticisms against Biden. Look, we will never know if the result would have been different had Biden stepped off earlier. We will never know if the results would have been different if he had stayed in. We will never know if the results have been different if there had been an open primary. What we do know is that Biden is in there for the next 2.5 months. And this is what I'm going to tell Joe. Joe, since they're talking smack about you anyways, you know what? Maybe pardon Hunter.
Yeah.
Pardon Hunter because... America just pardoned a criminal.
Yes.
Who was convicted of felonies.
Yes.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting take.
That was a strange, like, she's going one way and all of a sudden just like, you know what, pardon Hunter. I was like, where'd that come from?
what?
Why?
I kind of feel like it was like, everyone's already mad at you, just embrace it. Like, I feel like that was her point.
Yeah, just like, look out for your family.
Like, it's not like Julian Assange, you know? Like, we have a guy who's in trouble for influence peddling on behalf of a
foreign
at the time the vice president on behalf of foreign governments.
No, he's in trouble for doing drugs and having a gun.
That's what he got charged for. That's right.
Exactly.
Right.
It wasn't the whole Burisma thing.
Yeah. No.
Oh, that wasn't even it. Well, I mean, the Chinese were actually the thing that actually got them.
Yeah, no, but it's Chinese and Burisma are kind of like the two big things that are the things that are deserving of being looked at. But instead, they're like, you were under the influence with a gun.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Classic.
Yeah. Yep. Interesting take from The View. Always interesting to hear what they have to say.
When she's referring to Nancy Pelosi, is that Nancy did this interview, and we're not going to review it because it's tedious. But basically, she said makes the case that Biden shouldn't have run, right? So, and this is interesting. You got responses from like Anna Kasparian and other people who along with Nancy Pelosi, are pointing out that Biden was probably underwater from the very beginning and never had a chance. And they staff knew that, but they didn't want to give up their jobs.
And polling was put in place to not suggest that from the beginning?
Well, the public polling, of course, but the internal polling would suggest that he was too far down, that he was too old. He wasn't, people were too concerned about inflation. They had no response for inflation, of course. Like, that's what we saw in the election cycle. And then when she pressured him out, although she doesn't admit to it in the interview, the Seymour Hersh claims in his article about this that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi came to him and basically said, we're getting all the donors out. We're going to do all these things. If you don't pull out, we're going to use the 25th Amendment against you. Mm-hmm. And that was what caused Biden to drop out. Now, when that happened, the goal, according to Nancy, was they were going to have an open primary, even though the DNC at the time had collaborated with the Biden campaign all throughout the early part of the year to shut down primaries to keep people from being able to actually compete against Biden, to keep RFK off tickets. To keep, I forget the other guy, Dean, whatever, off the tickets.
Dean Phillips.
Yeah. Off of like Florida and various different tickets across the country. So what she says was the real, you know, reason why they didn't have a primary is because he didn't agree this with her, but then right after he pulled out, telling nobody, endorsed Kamala. Mm-hmm. So this is the thesis that you see going around the internet of that Biden actually was so pissed about getting pushed out that he actually helped Trump win by doing this.
Yeah.
And the other things like putting on the MAGA hat and all that kind of stuff.
And Joe Biden wearing red on election day.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Subtle nods to
a lot of
potential
nods there that exists there. Yeah. That is my favorite conspiracy theory right now, is that's the case.
That Biden voted for Trump.
Yeah. it's so small, but I just like, just feels so right.
So, and then she also makes the case that Democrats didn't do it as bad as being covered, that they could have lost more in the Senate and the House if international trends against incumbents had applied to the U.S. And there's some evidence of this. Ezra Klein has done a pretty thorough job of reviewing that. And I think there's a case there when you compare it to other Western nations and how bad incumbents are seen in those areas across their parties. But I also think that really underestimates gerrymandering and just the nature of American politics and how resistant to change Americans typically are. We don't see the same kind of swings that other countries do generally anyways. So I'm not sure how much she can do that. She can really claim that. That's pretty much the Nancy Pelosi thesis.
Yeah.
So the question is, another one is the campaign was so short, she couldn't establish herself, which is interesting. And there's this interesting New York Times article about it, about basically says it's a quote, how Kamala burned through $1.5 billion in 15 weeks.
Wait, it was 1.5? I thought it was just $1 billion.
No, according to the New York Times, I just pulled up the article right here. It's how Kamala Harris burned through $1.5 billion in 15 weeks. That's
wild.
Exactly what it is.
Yeah. And then there's a quote from it. It's, we had so much money, it was hard to get it out the door.
Like physically, they had it on pallets. It just wouldn't fit through the door.
That's where all that laundering money from Ukraine,
spree that averaged roughly $100 million per week.
That is wild.
That's how you create a useless Fortnite map.
Help me, I'm poor.
And an appearance from Beyonce where she doesn't perform, but you still pay her $10 million.
Yeah.
For 3 minutes.
For 3 minutes.
Wild.
Holy cow.
Most expensive prostitute in the world.
I was just going to make that joke.
I'm sorry.
See, it's $494 million on producing and buying media, a category that includes both television and digital ads. The total sum through the election is said to be closer to $600 million. And it's funny because Trump, didn't he tweet out a thing saying that they had a bunch of money left over and they would just pay for the debts that the Democrats were in too.
Yeah. You look at the total spent.
He's like, in an effort to collaborate and bring unity, we can cover the debts for you. Because, and he tweeted out something along the lines of, because we had this many views and earned media, which was practically free.
Yes, totally. Totally. And like their staffing expense was like 20% or 10% of what Kamala paid for staff. Which is just nuts.
There is an interesting thing, like the thesis there of the campaign was so short-lived that she couldn't establish herself out there. I think there is some truth to that, but also I just didn't feel like they were taking the opportunities to establish her out there. And a lot of the reports have been the internal staff conflict where they're like, oh, well, if she does that interview, half the staff will be mad at her. So she's not doing those interviews too. Like Rogan was one of those examples for one of the reasons allegedly she didn't do it.
And it's also just how poor of a candidate she was from the get. I mean, 1.5 months from her basically be endorsed by Biden to her first interview, where she still had to bring along Governor Waltz to the interview. Mm-hmm.
And we wonder why searches for has Biden dropped out, you know, why those were peaking on Election Day. She didn't ever get out and do that. But initially that was thought to be a benefit to her.
Well, I think the campaign saw it both ways, right? And this is definitely how a campaign strategist thinks about it, right? The best place you can be in a campaign is where you can be as small of a target as you need to be with a maximal impact. So by doing this, in theory, you can claim all the victories of the incumbency, which there are none with this incumbency. Like, it's just hard to point to any, right? It's really hard to point to any real wins.
He didn't take abortion away.
That are compelling to regular people.
Biden.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, he
did. Like, that's
do
all
something.
They had. Yeah.
Right. He couldn't even do that, right? Everything is an attack on Trump, right? So, and that's often seen as campaign strategy 101, right? You want to attack the opponent with minimizing your attacks. Obviously, that didn't happen because they were able to pin all the Biden administration stuff on her while she couldn't actually articulate why she was different than Biden. Remember, she got asked, you know,
how are you different?
How are you different? On the, I think the
I wouldn't
show?
Change a thing.
Yeah. Or she's like, I'm physically not Joe Biden.
I'm kind of retarded.
I'm also physically not Donald Trump. And like, that was her whole entire line.
Yeah.
So that strategy would look tempting to a campaign staffer, but it doesn't make any sense to everyday people because they're like, but you're vice president. Now, everyone inside DC knows vice presidents don't do anything, right? They vote in the Senate once every blue moon. They wield no real power. They can be influential on a president. Case example of that is like Bush's vice president, Cheney. Cheney, was very influential in the White House, but that was unique at the time. Very few vice presidents are that way. Joe Biden was picked by Obama simply because he was a white dude and non-threatening, right? And not a person who could really undermine him in the White House, yeah. Right?
Well, you've probably seen the meme of like Obama saying, I need a vice president that's dumber than me, and it's Biden. And Biden saying, I need a vice president that's dumber than me, and it's Kamala. And it's Kamala saying, I need a vice president that's dumber than me, and it's Tim Walz. It's like, it is a race to the bottom over there, that's right. For sure.
That is a tactic, though. Like, FDR did the same thing. It was like in kind of the effort of installing himself as dictator for life, which he was, kind of technically speaking. Yeah.
Interestingly, though, on the other side of the aisle, you see Trump arguably putting a guy who he may think is smarter than him in a lot of ways and who really is in a lot of ways with J.D. Vance. It's actually a much more like entrepreneurial approach where, you know, the adage is you want to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you, yeah. Right?
Well, it's also Trump is very, 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 very strong right now with his name ID popular across the country within the support within the party. It's hard to imagine anyone, even if they're more talented than him, which J.D. Vance might be, really having ability to undermine his support.
Sure.
Well, and Trump's also, he seems to be trying to empower the next generation too. Like, look how young his cabinet actually is. Yeah. Where the left's still kind of squabbling and doing these civil wars for their power games, it seems like Trump is like actually thinking about what happens beyond his presidency. Like, that's kind of what I'm getting signaled to me.
I hope so.
Right now.
I hope so.
So the other part of that was the leftists got their I told you so moment, which is it was too moderate of a campaign and they didn't focus enough on working class issues. And this really started the look in the mirror, which was Bernie Sanders issued a statement and then did a series of interviews. We have a YouTube interview on this. We want to dive into it. Mm-hmm.
I also pulled up the Bernie Sanders statement too, if you would just want to show that.
The statement from the quote is, quote, mm-hmm. It should come as no great surprise that a Democratic Party, which has abandoned working class people, would find that the working class has abandoned them. Great turn of phrase.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's also, the Democratic leadership defends the status quo and the American people want change. Like, it's kind of a hope and change moment that's existing right now. And they're sitting there like, we'll change, but we're also the same and we're not really sure. And they couldn't message it. Like,
we're not Donald Trump
at all.
And because once again, like you want to be the change candidate, mm-hmm. the candidate of joy and progress, right? Of getting rid of being unburdened or whatever. But you're also the incumbent, right? And you've wielded power. And on top of that, I can see the Bernie Sanders people, especially in this, being very, very frustrated, right? Because you're sitting there, you've committed to this Democratic Party project. You think that's the avenue for getting what you want. There really isn't another one in American politics. So I think they're in a pretty similar situation to how libertarians felt under Bush, where you're constantly saying, yeah, I'm kind of part of this group, but I hate everything they do.
Yeah.
I mean, could you imagine? I mean, other than like, what do they have really? The Inflation Reduction Act, kind of? That's only if they're really on the green side of that.
Didn't do anything about inflation?
Yeah.
And they didn't even market it right because like they could have marketed it like a green energy thing because that's what it was. It was all green slush fund stuff.
Yeah.
And but they marketed it as inflation, and then nobody's really feeling the inflation reduction, even though the rate of inflation has gone down, but it's like the prices are still up.
Yes.
You know, so they're just in this weird thing where all of their messaging is not working. Like it's bad. It doesn't relate to what people are feeling.
Well, and now you see Bernie Sanders coming out and saying, I'd love to work with Trump on this credit card interest rate cap situation that he's come out and said, which I know there are varying opinions on from an Austrian economic standpoint. We don't need to get too far into that, but it's interesting that Bernie's coming out now and crossing the aisle and saying, in some ways, symbolically, screw these people. I'm ready to work.
AOC, the same story, right? I mean, we made a joke last week about her removing the pronouns from her bio, now calling her a congresswoman, that sort of thing. And we also had this quote. It's our main project is to unite the working class against a fascist agenda, right? So they are saying, okay, we're going to abandon the woke left. We're going to still count on their votes and their count on their support, their activism, all that kind of stuff.
We'll
use them as a cudgel.
Exactly.
Right. But we're going to brand ourselves now as the working class group in order to try to regather that part of our demography. And I just don't know if it's going to take some time before that rebranding can really happen, because obviously they can promise more. They can say, we will tariff harder. They don't give a shit. Right. They'll say, we could subsidize more. We can do card check and things like that Republicans will never pass. Card check is basically removing anonymous voting from becoming a union. And various different other union reforms to try to make union busting harder and make union formation easier and union pressure and union power more strong.
But do you think that there's a component of that where the actual working class of the unions are recognizing that the union leadership is not on their same page?
Well, and I'm not guaranteed. So I think leftists identify working class with union, but I don't think that's actually how it works, right? Because working class much larger, union membership's way down across many states. Right to work has spread for good reasons, and I think a lot of people are skeptical of unions for good reasons. So I just don't know if, and obviously there are some good unions, right? But I just don't know that there is a clear case that cultivating more union votes means more working class votes, other than as a branding project.
Sure. Right?
You can more clearly say, hey, this guy who is on my side than the plumbers or whether Boilermakers or Teamsters or whatever supports me, and he's one of you, might work. But once again, how do you compete with Donald Trump's celebrity? Right. But that's only for this is a positioning for 4 years from now, not for now.
True. What else we got?
Do we want to do the Bernie Sanders YouTube interview?
Nah, we kind of covered it already. Okay. That's pretty much this case. Nancy actually responded in the same New York Times interview that I mentioned earlier and said, you know, basically, he's never won anything.
Bernie hasn't?
Got backstabbed.
Yeah, yeah, right. Because the DNC sabotaged his campaign.
Yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah, right. And then he said, I have great respect for
him. You're full of shit today.
That's what she was trying to say to him.
Well that's another area where the blowback of all the shenanigans that happened around the Bernie Sanders campaign and kind of cheating him out of the primaries in two elections was like, that woke a lot of people up on the left that ended up eventually going towards Trump in sort of the working class flow dynamic. I mean, Bennett is kind of in that. That was one of your wake-up moments.
That was
and Rogan. It was those two things, right?
Yeah, those are the things that kind of, I guess, was the chink in the armor, however you want to say it.
All of a sudden, like, the illusion shattered a little bit?
Yes, is that what it is? That's the better metaphor.
And now he's just been downing red pills, like, nonstop. It's like, every single time he comes in every week, he just, like, took another bottle of red pills.
About to OD on red pills.
So, I mean, especially if you're that person and you got that betrayed, I feel like that's probably how libertarians felt about the Ron Paul moment and how he got screwed over by Romney. So I can't blame them. That said, I don't see how they really get there all the way too, because Bernie has so given up the ghost. We have a link, and I do want to watch this one, Kyle. 10 days before the election, this is something that Bernie Sanders put out about Kamala Harris and the Biden administration.
I believe that President Biden, in many ways, has been the most progressive, pro-worker president since FDR.
Yeah. Think about that. Now, like, he was saying that 10 days before he wrote the thing about how the Democrats abandoned the working class.
I wish you weren't a liar.
What are we doing here? How does anyone take this guy seriously? It's ridiculous.
That is the thing that I feel
like. You would never catch Ron Paul doing that about, you know, campaigning for some fucking Republican saying, oh, he's the most free market person since, you know, Calvin Coolidge. You know, no way.
Well,
no way.
That was always the argument in 2016 too, right? Where people were comparing Ron Paul to Bernie Sanders. Because in a lot of ways, Bernie Sanders is the Ron Paul of the left, but that was Ron Paul never went and endorsed John McCain after he lost the election. Well, Bernie Sanders did go and endorse Hillary Clinton after she lost, or after he lost the election.
Right.
And it gets worse from there. Like, he keeps on campaigning for these people as they do new wars all over the country, all over the world, as they abandon the working class with the Inflation Reduction Act, driving all that towards green jobs. Now he can, you know, politician his way into justifying it. I'm sure he voted for it. But it's like, it's such an impoverished position if you actually had his philosophy,
well,
which is giving giant checks to major corporations just because they're your favorite major corporations.
Right. Well, I mean, the other piece of it is, too, he is a millionaire, not as much as some members of Congress, and he does have three homes.
Yeah.
As Dave Smith aptly pointed out on his show recently. And he's got a house on Lake Champlain, as Dave called it.
just a small summer home.
A small summer home. So it's like, it's a disingenuous position anyways to be saying down with the rich when he is one.
Well, he also made $1 million on a book about how it's bad to make $1 million.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
Saying he didn't donate all that to charity? I'm really surprised.
No, he
that.
Bought a house on Lake.
Lots of people do that. I don't know what you're talking about. So, yeah, I think the leftists are having their day. I really am skeptical of this narrative. I don't know if it's actually going to work because I think they've burnt up their credibility with that crowd so much. The Democrats Party's assessment is too woke. So we had Brianna Wu on Trigonometry this week as well. She was a former Gamergate reporter, like a news reporter for like Kotaku and like those sorts of like left-leaning game journalism. And then she went into politics and she ran for office a couple times. And she's a trans woman. And gets on and basically makes the case to these two comedians that, well, the problem is that they're too woke, functionally, the Democrats.
That's an interesting perspective coming from a trans woman.
Yeah, right.
You think that's an important part of your ideology.
Well, I think the difference is, and she makes this case, and honestly, I didn't know Brianna Wu was trans, to be honest, until this moment, until I watched it. I was like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. And that's because it's not like the thing that she leads with, right? It's not as critical to her identity. She wants to be known first as a reporter and a congressman and those sort of things. So
the deepfakes are getting better.
Yeah. Okay.
I plead the fifth.
Cut that out, Ben. Did you get
nope. Did you get fooled once on the internet or
no.
something?
No. Oh, okay. I was saying you did.
Oh, why?
Do we want to show it here? I got it pulled up.
I'm a terrible
Trump, but they don't like the Democratic elitists more. They hate us more. They hate progressives more. They hate the people that announce their pronouns more. They hate the people that do land acknowledgments more. They hate the people that derail every single conversation into racial grievance more. They are so sick of that. And until the Democratic Party can like back away from the abyss and turn into something that normal people are going to vote for again, yeah, Trump and the Republicans will stay in power. That's just a fact.
I mean, I think that's a very like honest take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a lot of viewers on that. And a lot of, I think that's probably the biggest take that most people are taking right now. It's like something about the trans ideology has really made the decision-making process in the campaign world impossible. So you can't make sound strategic decisions like Joe Rogan, for example, and not going on that. And it's also, you're just afraid everyone's gonna leak. Everyone's going to tell on you to the press, or someone's going to quit and write a nasty letter. That ideology comes first ahead of winning elections, which the Democrat Party traditionally is built on the maintenance and acquisition of power first. It hasn't been traditionally. They've had their factions, but those factions have been so united for so long. Hmm. It's really hard to imagine how we got to this place other than Obama taking his dose of that.
It's also just where the American public is right now. Like the two major things, I think, three major things, I suppose, is if you want to throw immigration in there, is just where the economy's at. And then just people are, I think, just done with the whole like woke shaming that everybody that has to go. Like everybody's kind of done walking on eggshells. I think everybody is starting to wake up because like the internet is where we live in the internet age right now. You can't micro target all of these groups anymore because like the traditional campaigning philosophy for decades was always you micro-target every single demographic with a very specific message. But now because the internet exists, everybody's seeing the same messages that you're trying to micro-target to people.
Right. It was like the situation that happened where they were Kamala was running a pro-Israel ad in one place and a pro-Palestine ad in another place.
Anymore.
Now both sides can see that they're being targeted with a different thing.
They have to sit there and be like, well, which one are you? But before, they could actually get away with it,
right?
Because everything was, it was much easier to confine the micro-targeting inside.
Well, and that's another example, too. And this is interesting because it comes with Brianna Wu, whose number one issue is Israel. Mm-hmm. Right? She said she almost voted for Trump because of Israel, because she thought Kamala was bad on Israel. Mm-hmm. That's how bad it is in that group.
Wow.
Now, this is not a place where I have a dog in the fight, but it's pretty clear to me that as far as for the leftist Bernie Sanders types, they're not on board with Bernie's position on Israel anymore. Much less Kamala's. So that's another major demotivator. All your activists who are most passionate, they're out and they're not going to work for you.
The whole identity is just like crumbling in front of it right now.
Yeah.
Well, they can't maintain all of these different groups together anymore. And they used to be able to do it. They maintained all these groups through fear of being like, you know, they're going to put you back in chains and they're going to take away your rights. And it's all the same fear tactics. And right. It's just like, and it's going, and the Republicans are going to hit you on that group, that group, that group, that group. All of your rights are gone. And now Trump went into office. And he was the one president in however many years that went into office, and none of that happened. And then they have to be like, well, that didn't happen. And then there's been 4 years without him, and inflation went up.
So. But he's Hitler.
So they're like, maybe this whole, like, maybe they're not going to just steal all the abortions away from us, and maybe we can get the economy going and I can buy food again. You know, like, that's kind of where they're sitting at right now.
But how
now.
Dare you prioritize buying cheaper eggs over the women and girls in your life, Kyle? How dare you?
Tim Dillon went on a rant, and it was kind of funny, where he was talking about, like, he's going to vote with the kids, like a mom going to vote with the kids, and was like, no, we have to vote because I need to have an abortion. And she's telling the kids that. And the kids, he's just like, I'm imagining the kids are really smart and they're asking her the questions like, but why are the interest rates so high, Mom?
So another part of that, and the pushback on this, and I do want to be fair here, is that Kamala didn't really run a leftist campaign, right? And we have this tweet from Secular Talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kyle Kalinske.
Yeah. I can't quite read it, Kyle.
It says, Kamala didn't mention race, gender, trans people, pronouns, Latinx, cancel culture, political correctness. And she did mention patriotism, freedom, owning a gun, representing all Americans, cracking down on the border. Anybody who tells you she was too woke is just fucking lying to you and caving into bullshit far-right framing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So this is the difference here. And what he's confusing is that what Brianna Wu's talking about is the Democrat brand, like the way our culture orientates to the overall branding of what it means to be part of that party, to run that party, to be an elite in that party, as opposed to the Republican brand in the moment. And honestly, the Republican brand runs on Trumpism right now for a lot of people who don't deserve it. A lot of people get cast with America First when that's not their foreign policy, for example. So it's like you have to conceptualize the political landscape as like the brands are these megaliths, these really big packages of ideas that people associate with and create values for that sometimes are applied to candidates, right? But the electorate doesn't always do that. And I think Kamala, because she's such a terrible public speaker, could maybe not public speaker, interviewer, and because her campaign strategy was to try to get as many Republicans who are afraid of Trump to vote for her, ran a very conservative campaign.
Oh, that's fair.
And therefore, never got to define herself away from Trump, and therefore actually ended up just looking like milquetoast Trump, right? Which is another criticism, right?
Something I will say with these types like Kyle Kalinske is, this is just my reading of the situation, is so one thing that's happened is all of these big left-wing YouTubers that have like a lot of subscribers, a lot of followers on all their accounts and stuff, like they're very big in that space. They've seen an apocalypse of tens of thousands of subscribers leaving them after the election, just people checking out. But also Kyle Kalinske here, Secular Talk, he used to be seen as one of the sensible left-wing people. He would go on Joe Rogan and he was one of the sensible lefty types. He was a Bernie bro, all this. And then eventually at some point he was kind of like being friendly with Republicans and like the conservatives and the libertarians. He was kind of being friendly with them because he agreed with them on foreign policy and all this stuff. And then there was a moment somewhere in there that happened a couple of years ago where all of a sudden his viewership just dropped, and all of a sudden he just became a completely different person, and he went way more into the woke side. Interesting. Which, so when I'm reading this tweet from him, I'm like, I'm seeing what's happening there.
Right. Well, and there's that other angle too, is people are, I think, differentiating some key issues that actually have prevented the left wing from being able to take much ground on making a compelling case for the wokeness, right? In this sense, Brianna Wu's impression of Trump is that he's going to literally end adult transition rights, like ban it, like it's been banned in Texas or something like that.
Which he's never said. Like his position has always been, and everyone around him for the most part, his positions have always just been, got to be 18.
Yeah.
that's all this.
Don't do it to the kids.
Yeah. Stop transing the kids, which I think is another area, even though it's a small amount of people that the transing the kids things actually happens to, it's become such a big cultural phenomenon where everybody's just like, wait, they're doing what to the kids now? Like it's one of these things where there's just like, there's this, then there's this, then there's this. And it's like, now you're doing what to the, they're transing the kids. Right. Really?
Well, and that's where it touches on something that loses them, especially the working class people, right? Where they're saying, hey, wait, you know, I'm okay if you want to have gay marriage and I'm okay with these things. But as soon as there's a drag queen story hour at my local library, now I'm like, wait a minute.
Right.
You know, this is a different culture. I don't live in the city for a reason.
Right.
I think a lot of that is the underlying like social milieu and like the underlying cultural values that once you start messing with kids, a lot of regular family oriented people are going to be like, I'm not with you anymore.
Yeah.
And you're just going to lose. Those people aren't going to go out to vote when they normally would, or they'll vote for Trump, especially because they can differentiate between adults and children. They'll say, well, okay, it's one thing for it to be adults and nothing for it to be kids.
Yeah.
And I don't think I think the messaging from the Democrats to get the woke right and the woke left out, sorry, I did a James Lindsay there, was felt on deaf ears to the larger public, right? Because the only people who heard that as a danger was people like Brianna Wu, right?
Yeah.
Well, and one of the areas too is all these big, like formerly left-wing mega donors and like Democrat donors, people like, say, Bill Ackman, Chamath Palihapitiya, those people who now went and became big donors for Trump. They will actively say, like, they'll be on podcasts and they will see, you know, say, back in 2016, I fell for the compassion narratives. Like, I fell for all the left wing kind of bullshit. And because I used to believe that the New York Times was credible, like that, they'll all say that type of stuff. Like, I used to believe the Wall Street Journal, I used to believe the New York Times. And now I've realized you can't believe what they're saying. And that was one of the big things that caused them to flip sides. Also, just like looking at economics and things like that, too. Right. But a lot of those people, like, there's like, yeah, we should be compassionate about the trans issue. We should be compassionate about this or that. Or it's like, yeah, it does sound bad that Trump's going to do that. And then they just took like an ounce of digging into it a few years later. And they're like, oh, this is all bullshit. Yeah. It's all bullshit. Right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a lot of people's first instinct is to be compassionate. I mean, some people are not going to err that way innately, but most people want to see themselves that way and be that way and treat their neighbors well until, like you said, that ideology starts to get impressed upon your kids, people that you care about, and it becomes more than you can possibly tolerate in a society where you want to let people do their own thing for the most part.
Well, it's easier to be compassionate when it's happening over there. But then when it actually becomes close to home, they're just like, wait, you're doing what the fuck to my kids?
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Or what happened at the parade that's now all over Twitter.
Right.
When I see it and I'm like, wow, that was done in public and everyone's cool with that.
That's a bunch of gay dudes in thongs in front of kids dancing around in like every major city, it seems like. Multiple times a year, it feels like at this point.
Well, and like the difference there is like America's a big place with a lot of different cultures, right? In San Francisco, that's been going on forever. No one cares. You live in San Francisco. It kind of goes with it.
It's part of the culture.
But
it goes with San Francisco. Yeah. It's Berkeley culture right there. Yeah.
But the internet kind of makes this mass milieu and many identities within that then tear up to these things and then you get watershed moments, which can be, you know, give you a false impression of the overall picture, which I totally get that. Some people think every college campus is Berkeley or every college campus is the same. It's not. Lots of different college campuses have lots of different cultures that go along with it. It can give you a bad impression of the overall segment. But that doesn't mean when running a national political campaign, that isn't going to be an underlying motive when you overextend that way. And it's the same thing. If Republicans were killing abortion doctors, you know, we would have a problem with this on the right now. But for whatever reason, the circumstance, the unifying figure of Trump, the messaging has been way tighter on the right than I've ever seen before on things like that. Right? I mean, there are factions of the right who do want to ban adult transition therapies. Right? Mm-hmm. But they're the minority.
And or ban all immigration or something like
right.
that. Like, there's all these radical factions that exist. Mm-hmm. Most people within the right wing are actually fairly moderate on their positions. There are these extreme factions, and those would end up usually getting blown up in the media space mm-hmm. as being like, see, this is what Trump wants to do. And you're like, okay.
Right. And that worked at one point, and now it doesn't. And now people are kind of taking the smaller segments and the more radical segments of the Democrats, and they're casting them on a larger Democrat. In part because the Democrats are so beheld by this, they can't disavow them, right? And keep their coalition together at this point.
Yeah, that's very true.
So the other part is it's, and I like Ezra Klein, probably has one of the better ones on this, is he thinks this is the death of the Obama coalition. But I think it's the right way to think about it. So remember 2008 and what happened in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. You have the rise of the Tea Party and the rise of Occupy Wall Street. With all that pressure on financial institutions, you had this strange pivot where they all went very left. They all got on board with Obama, and you saw a very interesting pivot away from the Bernie Sanders like leftism to a more Obama, we like technology, we like Wall Street, but we're really focused on, and this is a Hillary Clinton quote, ending the banks won't end racism, right? And that like pivot to social issues instead of economics and like the more progressive vision for economics has undermined their case to the point where you're now losing the working class. Additionally, that the reflexive defense of all institutions, right, of saying, well, I mean, we need the war in Ukraine. I mean, obviously, we need the military industrial complex now. Once you're defending those institutions, you're no longer stirring left passion against those institutions that they spent a decade and a half advocating against. And so, like, Obama subtly switched them all pro-war over time. Saw this with Syria. Initially, you know, couldn't get the support he wanted to actually declare war in Syria. So what he did is he did a backdoor using covert ops and stuff like that. Using the Arab Spring, Libya, what else am I thinking on? Somalia and a bunch of other countries.
Egypt.
All of those operations were then done under him, right? And you can see, like, the over part of that with Libya, for example, and Hillary Clinton's wars, those things are now kind of identified with leftism. So now she can, you know, go around with Liz Cheney and credibly talk about how Donald Trump's a threat to the global world order. And leftists just can't go along with that. At least the people who are most passionate, who are mostly going to be the people who are going to articulate for your campaign.
It is interesting. I've seen a lot of discourse on this about Obama, where there's a lot of people that are like, I'm kind of mad at the Democrats, but they always viewed Obama with this extremely positive light. And I'm seeing a lot of those people saying recent months have completely changed their views on Obama. Mm. And it has to do with a lot of people that thought he was fairly honest in general, you know, scandal free, of course.
No scandal.
But then they watched him because, like, there's people that exist on the internet and they know the things like the both sides narrative is a hoax and they know the Russia stuff is a hoax and they know all this. But then they saw Obama parroting all those things that have been debunked years ago on the campaign trail. And they're like, oh, he's just like everybody else. Like, I've seen a lot of people have that, like, light bulb moment in recent months because of that.
Well, same with him calling out the brothers. That was
another big one. Yeah.
A lot of backlash after that one.
Yeah. So, like, I think there's something true there where the Obama thing is just gone. And I think that's the reason why Michelle never ran or, like, never jumped into the ring. There was always discourse on that. And that was the theory that I proposed on this podcast was I think that they're worried about the Obama legacy. I don't think that they can... I think that there's going to be so much dirt that gets brought up if she was the one that ran there, where it would just be over for it. So, like, this historical moment that he had where it's like first black president, perfect president, scandal free, all these things, all of that would have been gone away if it ended up being him or Michelle versus Trump.
For sure. Yep. For sure.
The other part of one of the other assumptions was more Latinos and black vote equals Democrat victory, which has been surprising. Like, we've covered it too. Like, the minority shift on Trump. Now, Latinos shouldn't surprise people as much as it does because Bush won the Latino vote. People forget that. But with the increase in amount of Latino vote, total amount of voters.
I did forget that.
Over that time. I feel like I'm always bringing it up, but I always have to remind people.
You brought it up recently.
I wasn't listening to him then.
You said because Bush spoke Spanish, which I didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hola.
He was governor of Texas. So.
I put it together after.
So that assumption turned out to be false, that Republicans could cultivate more minority votes out of those communities. And you wonder if that's Republican positioning or just Trump as a figure. I don't know which of those is. It's hard for me to tease that out. I don't really understand. And I haven't seen anything yet that really explains why
I think
Trump
it's third option. The narrative wore off that the Democrats had captured, like the mind virus that they had planted has largely been cured. I think because I think it was just the racist narrative was so strong for so long, especially during the Obama era. And now everybody's like, nah, they're not racist.
Yeah.
And they're just like, you know, we can stop doing this now. And I think it's just worn off. And now all these groups are starting to come in. Yeah. A lot of the pandering too. I think a lot of people are sick of being pandered to.
Is it that like things like Black Lives Matter promise so much and then so underdelivered? Right? Like
also it was just so blatantly corrupt.
Yeah.
Like I think a lot of people were like, yeah, compassion, Black Lives Matter for like a year, and then they realized how corrupt it was.
Or then they did that. They said that. They gave their support. And then that support went to the political power of Marxist radicals who were like, and now we're going to end all police.
And all the owners of the
organization. Wait a minute. I don't want to end all police. I want to.
And all the owners of the organization got super rich and bought multiple houses.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much people know that. I think that's a good case. I don't know how much regular people know that. But I do think is the general impression is that that was a grift.
Yeah.
Right? And that griftiness has jaded them on this whole narrative and made them resistant like a virus.
I think black men in general have believed that it's a grift.
Yeah.
And I think it's also just because of like where black men in general tend to get their media from. They see the grift, and I think they're seeing it more than black women just because of the demographic difference of where they go for media and kind of the things that they're involved in. Mm. A lot of black men in general, like they you know, highest demographic in crypto, you know, for instance, and that's a super libertarian space, right? Yeah. You know, there's all these like massive conspiracy theory type of stuff of like believing how much they want to try to control the group that exists in those communities. I think those things are very pervasive in that community, and so like I think black men in general broke out of the spell much faster than a lot of groups.
Didn't you say Rogan was the biggest podcast for black men as well?
Yeah. I mean, he's the biggest podcast in 90 countries in the world, right? Like he's the biggest podcast for everybody. Yeah. Right?
That's a big podcast.
That is.
God damn.
And the last part of that assumption of the Obama coalition was that unions and working class people would forever be blue just because they'd always has been. And that was just turned out to be a false premise. And that's why Trump is so dangerous for them. Now the question is that a Trump phenomena, or is that a position phenomena the Republican Party can take and move forward on or not?
I think it has to be a little bit of both. I mean, right, like you're seeing just like the larger macroeconomic factors. People are seeing themselves and their families worse off now than they were under Trump before. And then also you have like the cult of personality stuff, you know, the being relatable, identifying with him, the way that the justice system has gone after him, I think has probably resonated with people who have had the justice system go after them systemically in a lot of ways for a long time with the war on drugs and many other things. Like it has to be a combination of factors that's pulled such a broad coalition of people into this tent.
I've definitely heard that if felons could vote, that Trump would have the felon vote.
I have to imagine.
I've heard
he's
that.
One of us.
And I've always wondered to what degree there was like a separation between the more liberal cultural stuff, the, you know, LGBTQ crowd and the black vote. And because of online, because of podcasting, that's all seen in one picture now. And so then they're more at a conflict of like, well, can I really support these guys given their reputation for advocating things that I'm so in disagreement with culturally? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's just a big thing is we had about a decade there of being cast under a spell, and whatever ritual voodoo magic they did for that has all worn off.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
really as like it's just all the tactics that they had before, they don't work anymore. We have new technology of how we distribute information. It's all gone. Like I really think a lot of the media and the Democrats in general, they thought that the media apparatus they still had control over the narratives. And this really feels like it might have been the first election where they completely lost control of it.
Totally.
And a lot of it has to do with Twitter, Joe Rogan, all these comedians that have become kind of more right-wing coded that are generally supportive of Trump. Like their audience are going to be Trumpers, right?
Yeah.
It's
speaking of which, I mean, the other one of the arguments has been the left has lost media domination. And they're actually talking about this openly. Mm-hmm. The way they say it is we need a Joe Rogan.
you had one.
Yeah, you could have had one. He was a Bernie bro.
Yeah, you had the Joe Rogan.
You had Joe Rogan. Time.
How did they lose Joe Rogan? It was trans issues?
Women
in sports?
Horse dewormer?
Men in sports. No.
Yeah,
sports.
They demonized him for his
COVID
stance on COVID.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the biggest one.
Look, yeah, because now you have guys like the biggest comedians in the world, Joe Rogan and Tony Hinchcliffe, saying that they get their political news from Dave Smith.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That is crazy. That is really cool.
Interesting network effects. So Mia from Morning Joe put out had a reaction in this thread on disinformation from podcasting.
I believe it's Mika.
No, it's Mia.
Mika Brzezinski.
Oh, Mika. Right. You're right.
Yeah, the daughter of the war criminal.
Yes.
That Mika, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Zbigniew Brzezinski.
All right.
Great. Yeah,
here it is.
A lot of the different aspects of what happened here, and I think a major part of it, and as we talk about the Democrats, I sometimes feel like we overtalk about that, and then it leaves out other reasons why this election was lost by the Democrats, and that would be disinformation. And Michael, you were writing about, you know, why doesn't anyone talk about the real reason Trump won, and you're talking about right-wing media in part. Can you explain?
Sure. And look, there were immediate reasons that had to do with inflation and the economy and so forth. But what I was trying to draw readers' attention to with this column is a longer historical problem that I've watched develop over the last 30 years, which is the growth, tremendous growth in size mm-hmm. and influence of the right-wing media in this country. When we talk about the media, usually in shorthand, we say the media this, the media that, as if it's one thing. But actually in this country, we have two medias, and I think it's very important for people to understand this. There's mainstream media, which is, you know, the networks and the New York Times and so forth, and then there's a right-wing media. And when we think of right-wing media, we all think first of Fox News, but it's much larger and vaster than that. There are other cable networks. There's talk radio, right-wing talk radio, which is everywhere across this country. There's right-wing Christian radio. Right-wing networks have bought up local television, local radio, some local newspapers, and then there's this whole world of social media and podcasters that is just absolutely vast.
Yeah.
Add it all up, it's tremendously influential, and it really does, more than the mainstream media these days, I think, Mika, set the terms of our political conversation.
And do you think that, are we also talking about disinformation or just a lean to the right in terms of how they, the point of view that is presented?
Force the narrative.
Well, sure, there's both.
Isn't that clip in the right time, right? I mean, it's just so perfect.
Oh, sure.
There's a magic to the proper ending of a clip. You know? and that was it right
that
there.
That was it.
But what about disinformation, Joe? First off, congratulations winning the election. Good job, podcasting. Good job, everyone.
You're
guys,
welcome.
We won.
You're welcome.
We won.
Take that,
MAGA.
Corporate media. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think it is. It's cope.
Oh, hell yeah.
Right, they just can't compete.
Guys, have you heard about this podcasting
thing? Yeah, it's sort of this emergent phenomenon that's happening.
It's new. It's brand new.
It's very new.
But that's how it seems like. It's like they're looking at it and they're like, oh, these people, these silly people in their basements with their microphone and their camera and their low budget productions. You know, like that's how they like. Yeah. They don't even have 20 people on staff. It's crazy.
It's crazy. How did they get anything done?
How could they possibly? They don't even have anyone write their scripts for them. How crazy is that?
You know what I think is an interesting phenomenon right now that podcasts don't have an advantage over is we don't have like newsrooms of reporters gathering actual information on the ground. I think that's where podcasts have the biggest opportunity to grow, is bringing that component in, the actual news gathering. Because like these guys, you know, have fields of reporters. We're just responding to what they're saying. But how long is that narrative going to last? How long is that paradigm going to exist before podcasts can usurp the legacy press in that way? Also,
are you saying that we need to get our boy Ethan as a White House correspondent?
I might be saying that. I mean, we do know the Trump administration has said they will welcome podcasters and alternative media personalities into the press room. So. I think maybe we should try our hand, you guys.
Human reaction people. White House correspondent?
Ooh,
let's
go.
Interesting.
We did send people during the live stream to go to in the field reporting.
That's right.
At the courthouse.
I do. I think there's something to that. There's long been a gap. That gap precedes the moment in the sense of shoe leather reporting has been on the decline for a very long time. it's on the decline because of what?
I was just thinking of Tucker Carlson's email response.
Oh, yeah.
Where he literally said, "Truth of the report." Yeah, now I only think of that.
Okay. It's a classic phrase. Of that start out to your media career where you're actually the person who goes to the wreck, talks to the police, talks to the coroner, who actually does on-the-ground reporting. Now, that still happens. It happens on your local newspaper, but it doesn't really happen on scale as much as it used to in the newsroom. Most newsrooms now are dominated by internet researchers who don't do anything different than what we do. So that I think that's your impression of more shoe leather journalism happening is actually probably false.
Oh, interesting.
At least on the CNN level. It happens at your Daily Chronicle level or your Daily Gazette level, but doesn't happen at that level.
So they're just reading some news wire from the AP or whatever, or and just publishing it?
Or they're getting emails from the CIA saying, cover this.
Yeah, just like us.
Bennett, can you get us an email listserv from the CIA?
At least 50% of our talking points are fed from the CIA through Bennett.
CIA is getting based lately. But I mean, I'm only...
We're controlled opposition.
Obviously.
We're a limited hangout. Yeah. But the interesting thing is, I think what you're right about is their comparative advantage there, and that's where like people like Tim Pool got their chops. Like he started out doing on the ground reporting at Occupy Wall Street.
No, Egypt. He was in Egypt during the uprising.
Yeah, during the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
So things like that are still where you can gain. There's an incentive structure there for podcasting. I think the biggest thing is just like that gap of going from there to commentary, where you can really publicize and get the word out about new stories. From the ground straight up to podcasting, bypassing the corporate press.
Can I ask you guys a question? Because just we've brought up the Arab Spring a couple of times. This is going to go off topic. Sorry, Bennett. What did you guys think of that in the moment? Did it feel authentic to you? Like, what was your impression of it as you were kind of ingesting that movement as it happened?
It's hard to say for me because I was still in high school when it was happening, I believe.
Just a boy.
Yeah, a lot of like the Libya, the Egypt, that stuff was happening when I was still... It was like in the early days of my political formation. Like, I really started to like notice politics was a thing that existed in the world during the John McCain Obama administration. I was like in eighth grade when that happened. And then I became more interested in politics while I was in high school. So like it's at the time, I think I was just buying whatever like Fox News was saying on it.
Yeah. I was reading a book. It's called Revolt of the Public, which is very much informative of the way to think about how social media networks have changed politics. Interesting book, but unlike the Mike Benz thesis, right? Because this was written prior to knowledge of CISA, I took it as an interpretation of the network effects of social media, that it was organic bottom up. And there's still a sense in which that's still true. It's just that the diplomacy 2.0 State Department effort at the time was to capture that bottom up momentum and then professionalize it, focus it, amplify it, make it more of a thing on behalf of the State Department. So it is both true and untrue at the same time, as is typical of covert ops. Right?
Sure. Because I think I'm in that camp. I mean, I certainly, as it was happening, I was like following it every day on Twitter. I was following Egyptian journalists and people on the ground at the protests and like, you know, just riveted to this story as it happened, feeling that it was very authentic. And then to kind of come full circle at this point and to know more about the you know, these sort of operations that go on covertly to manipulate our information and our perception of events that are happening around the world. Like, I've come to see it as like, oh, that was an op. But at the time, I was like totally bought in.
Dude, I assumed it was real until Mike Benz's reporting on it, right? Until we really discovered the breadth of U.S. State Department efforts to use social media as a tool of statecraft.
Yeah.
And that changed everything to me. I mean, and I've been on a journey in the last 2-3 years on that question of, okay, so how far does this rabbit hole goes in terms of use of covert ops to manipulate the American public and international? Because I always assumed it was there, but you kind of put it into the picture of like James Bond stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, you hear about the torture chambers, you hear about those sorts of things, but then you don't really contextualize it as, wow, those people are willing to do that. They're willing to go way further. And then now we have so much evidence built up in the use of these tools, it's hard to see anything as organic.
Yeah.
That's also probably an error, because there still are bottom up organic things that happen.
Yeah.
For all kinds of reasons.
I took a lot of red pills when I was like 19 or so, and I got pretty based on that and always kind of instinctually believed it was there. I was pretty like, okay, especially on the social media stuff.
Cooler than all the rest of us.
But especially on the social media stuff, like I went from like your Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck Republican in high school, Mitt Romney Republican even, because like that happened when I was a senior in high school, to like 2 years later, just going like full ANCAP anarchist, and then taking a pretty like, doing deep dives into things and following reports. Like I was pretty aware of the CIA/FBI influence going on in Facebook probably in like 2015 or so. Like I was pretty aware of it. And the thing is, the New York Times was aware of it too. Like there was New York Times reports about it.
Sure.
But it wasn't a sexy topic at that point where everybody like believed it. Like everybody knew that Facebook had a trustworthiness score and they were really controlling narratives, and that there was CIA assets that were working in with Twitter and manipulating algorithms in the Middle East to try to like steer things in certain directions. Like it was, you could see that it was there at that time. It's just, it wasn't like the sexy topic like it is now.
I think it kind of blew up around the Cambridge Analytica scandal, right? Where it came to light that like, you know, people were using Facebook to manipulate elections around the world,
yeah,
to influence public perception.
Yeah. And it was one of those things, 'cause like, it was really surprising to me. Like I like to rag on libertarians. As Bennett knows.
Mark off your bingo cards, everybody. Yeah.
Like,
take a drink.
That was the really surprising thing, was in 2020, especially while COVID was going on. Like, it was like how many people that I felt like philosophically, I feel like they should have understood and instinctual, like had the instincts of everything that was going on around COVID, everything that was going around social media, the Hunter Biden laptop story, all that stuff. But then I just like saw everybody just fall for the narratives of everything, and it made me realize at that time how much control the corporate media and that whole apparatus and how that system still had. Like I had thought that maybe we had beaten that by that point, but now it's like in 2024, it's like, okay, now I think we've actually beaten it. Like now the trajectory is really strong for it feels like the average person paying attention kind of gets it. Like they instinctually understand this now.
I think we'll really know we've won when Elon buys MSNBC. That'll be that. No, and then CNN. Installs CNN. Or whatever.
Or when Elon buys the CIA.
And sure installs Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Back on topic.
So one more is two more really that I want to make sure we hit. And before we hit on to the Trump and foreign policy thing, is one of the narratives that isn't arising at all is Kamala as a flawed candidate. The right talks about it, but the left is not, that I could tell. No one's really willing to criticize her.
She's a black Indian woman. Of course she was great.
Well, I
mean, she had all the celebrity endorsements.
And the way they...
Beyonce endorsed her.
Queen Latifah.
Eminem. They all got the Diddy call.
For example, say her name right. Right, and that narrative of like, if you say her name wrong, you're a racist. Those sorts of like,
I'm gonna be honest, I don't know what the proper way is to say her. It's gone back and forth so many times. I don't get it. I don't know what the proper way is.
Well, they did it on the campaign trail.
I try my best.
David is hooked on phonics, and even he knows how to pronounce it.
Okay.
Get it right.
Kamala?
Like comma?
Like comma? Camelot?
Like a comma? Comma, la. Okay.
I've been saying Kamala this whole time. Am I a bad person?
I have too. A little bit. It's a thing. Okay. I actually got corrected while doing the research.
Well, here's the thing. She said it both ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And so does Biden. And so does almost everyone who works around her. It was only used as a weapon to attack Republicans when convenient, with a racist slur like thing. Black woman or Asian or what, you know, what race is she? All that kind of confusion around that wasn't in her benefit, right? In her inability, her switching of accents. And that getting exposed, I think, was really...
That was so weird.
It's so weird. It's funny that Hillary does that, too.
Everyone does. AOC does it. Everyone does it.
I think it's for
Trump.
Well, I think it's a bit of human nature, actually. I mean, it's sort of a component of mirroring, right? Like, you humans tend to emulate their counterparts'
mannerisms. For one night? well, in a year?
It might have been a little more manufactured in her case. Like, it might have been a tactical thing, but like, humans do tend to do this. Like, if you're leaning back in your chair and we're having a conversation, I will tend to lean back in my chair also to make you feel comfortable so that we build rapport. That is a natural human.
But it's weird
instinct.
When it's a speaking engagement. Yeah. It's different for a conversation versus giving
if
a
you're
speech.
Giving, I don't disagree. If you're giving a scripted speech, yeah. I would assume that you would probably give the speech in the way that you rehearsed it. Over that week's
I would
time
agree.
Area.
I would agree.
Yeah, especially with the comma.
I wonder if the speech had the instruction, speak in accent.
Speak it. Make sure to enunciate these letters for this group of people.
You
they like
thank
that.
A union member.
I think another one of the narratives of the campaign.
Remember,
of joy,
you're in the South.
I think one of the other narratives is the campaign of joy narrative and how short-lived that was as a way to inoculate against her cackling.
And they were so miserable. Right. Like, that's the thing is, like, they're like, we're bringing joy. And then they were so miserable to everybody.
So was that Kamala's like weird moment where like they did the focus group and they're like, oh, she's just like, she seems really stern. Or is this a way for us to like differentiate her from Trump in the way that like
Trump is
very stern?
Wrong direction. It was that her laugh and her unseriousness as a VP candidate was so transparent that in order to fight that, they leaned into that because they knew they couldn't change that part of her personality. And so they were like, oh, the laugh is and the cackling is just it's her joyness.
I think that's fair. It's interesting to me how juxtaposed it is with all of the narratives you get out of the rumors around her campaign staff saying she was like a total like terror to work for.
Yeah.
And she was always really mean and like yelling at everyone. Like it's just that's an interesting component to me as well. But I think you're
she's like one of the highest turnover rates ever.
Yeah.
Of staff.
And it's interesting because if that's her public persona, is this like thing?
I love Venn diagrams.
Anytime she's off script or anytime she's, you know, when she's campaigning, she has this inability to articulate her thoughts in a clear way. It became a way to lean out of that by leaning into it, right? You basically say, well, this is how her attitude in politics is, this should be joyful. And so that's the attitude she wants to bring to it. And it was so shallow and stupid. It didn't last.
It's also bringing the joy, but you're also the ones like shaming everybody for being happy ever. And it looks like everybody else on the other side is just having so much fun right now. Like that's another element. I was like, the right was just having a good time. The memes were fun. They were calling Puerto Ricans trash.
Great. MSG was a perfect example of that.
True.
Yeah.
Everybody's doing
garden.
The Trump dance. Like everything's like memed out and it's fun. Like it's just like everybody's singing the YMCA. Well, it was great.
And Trump himself in interviews would tell jokes knowing that they would probably get taken out of context.
Yeah.
And then used against him, like the dictator on day one thing. Like this is obviously a joke. It's obviously not serious.
Right.
Yeah. J.D. Vance seemed like a cool person to kind of be like spit ideas around with. Mm-hmm. You know, you had people like Vivek and Elon. Like Elon is just a meme lord on Twitter. Like he's the top 20 Diablo player in the world. Like it's crazy.
One of the last parts of the narrative of Democrats losing is why did Democrats lose that aren't being discussed? And I do think I have one that I think is more interesting because it's critical of both sides a little bit better. I think there's a deep irony to Trump winning this election because of inflation. Because inflation exists now the way it does because of the fallout of the COVID response that was inevitable because of his signing of the various stimulus bills to bail out as lockdowns were going on. Now, his argument is that this is a necessary thing because governors were locking down, but governors could only lock down because of the state of emergency that he declared.
Mm.
Therefore, these are, and he didn't push to end lockdowns, really, right? I mean, he didn't have to. He saw that as a 10th Amendment at play. I could see that argument. But at the end of the day, the inflation happened because we went parabolic on M2 money supply in 2020, where it goes vertical. And we are just paying the consequence of that. Therefore, you know.
So is there an irony to the expectation that Trump can fix inflation?
If only because inflation will decrease as the economy processes through the production possibility frontier of the increased money supply. So you have the available amount of production that the economy can give any given time. This is the basics of the Hayekian triangle. What inflation in the money supply does is it signals that there's more resources to expand production, but then that doesn't actually exist. It's a false signal. So then you get the problem of increasing prices to keep up with that false signal. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So when that happens, eventually when production catches up, you'll see a leveling off of prices. Additionally, that Fed interest rate's increasing. obviously slowed that down a little bit. Fed interest rates are probably not going to go up. I wouldn't guess, obviously not financial advice, but they're probably going to go down. And Trump's efforts is really a gamble on can he grow the economy due to a cut in regulations and either maintaining or doubling down on tax reform with a decrease in spending of government to increase per capita GDP. Again, because of increased economic growth to outgrow that curve of the inflation problem.
Yeah.
Will he cut spending is the big question at the end of the day. And everything, there's signals for that, but it's going to require pressure. It's going to require a tremendous amount of pushback when the sky is falling, pushback to spending cuts happen.
There's one area, and this is kind of a question to pose to you, and we can maybe close on this question, is it feels to me, and this is a result of the internet age right now, that the reason why the left is actually beginning to lose is because they're appealing to the low information voter, but I feel like the average public is becoming more high information when it comes to politics mm-hmm. because of the internet age. And the left has had a monopoly on the low information voter for so long, but people are becoming more engaged and more aware of everything right now because of the internet, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think what we're going through right now with the amount of attention everyone is paying to the cabinet appointments, like more than I've ever experienced. Granted, mm-hmm. my adult political life is limited in comparison.
It's never
to some,
been this important, it seemed like.
But it does feel like a tremendous change. Like it's far more than it ever has been.
Well, and I also want to add, because like we noticed this change of one of the biggest discrepancies. It's not the male versus female vote. It's the educated versus the uneducated. But when it comes to political education, it seems like the uneducated, the non-college voter, seems to be more educated when it comes to politics. And I think a lot of it is because like the middle class worker, they're listening to podcasts. The average truck driver is listening to podcasts, right?
Fair point.
Like the average, well, all of the educated people, they're like, oh, I listen to NPR and the New York Times, right?
On my way to work where I sit at a desk.
But they're
and
being
I do
fed
focus
the
work.
Thing. And yeah. But they're also being fed the narrative where a lot of people are like having very diverse views of the political landscape because of podcasting and YouTube videos and this whole thing right now. And I think that's one of the areas that is almost under talked about is like the people that are not college educated are self-educating themselves in the matters of the world that I think are the most important to them. And politics is one of those areas right now. Right.
And that's
where,
right.
Yeah.
It might play out in the whole Inflation Reduction Act being the new Green Deal is you promised inflation reduction and you gave us corporate bailouts.
Scammy green slush funds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if the average person says, I really cared about inflation and then you didn't do anything about it, That'll kill you. The
and they can
right
just
there.
Go on Twitter and they see like all these people that they trust are talking about. It was like, oh, this thing that they said was this thing is not actually this yeah. thing. How many other of those things are like that?
The same way right. the same way the Patriot Act is now understood as not being about national
about
security.
Patriotism.
Yeah, right.
It's about brand. Like anybody could be a terrorist among us.
Exactly.
Totally. All right. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap it up. We'd love to know what you guys think. What do you think the largest reason is that the Democrats failed to win this election? We'd love to know. Let us know in the comments.
Come talk to us in our Discord.
And come talk to us in our Discord. And if you'd like to get access to our exclusive content, the Skiff, our members-only show, humanreactionpod.com. Thanks for watching. Hit the like button, follow us, and subscribe wherever you check this out. I'm Joe Sheehan for David Rand, Kyle Mack, and Bennett on the Buttons. This is Human Reaction. We'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember,
if liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?